From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I've launched an independent investigation into allegations of misconduct against me by an employee of the Illinois Treasurer's Office. Let me just make this perfectly clear. There's absolutely no truth to the allegations, no factual support or merit. I can't tell you the one that made the accusation, and I can't tell you what the accusations are because I am barred from doing so. But what I can tell you, that there is a specific request for $300,000, and I will quote, "We will walk away and keep it under wraps." And then when you look at the attorney that's representing, she's been paid by Bruce Rauner. I got to tell you what, Illinois politics is hardball. And the one thing I know, we've seen another person enter the race with millions and millions and millions of dollars who is specifically noted to say he's going to destroy his opponents. Nice try. Rutherford is staying in this race. I'm going to turn this back on him, and I'm going to be the Republican nominee, and by the time January 2015 comes, I'm taking the oath of office as governor of the state of Illinois. Now, if there's no other repeat questions, I'll stand here and take all you want.
That's Republican gubernatorial candidate and state treasurer Dan Rutherford. Rutherford is one of four candidates vying for the Republican nomination. Those remarks came last Friday as he alleged that there were allegations against him that were politically motivated, possibly by one of the opponents, Bruce Rauner, also in the race, Kirk Dillard and Bill Brady. The old TV series Soap opened up by saying, "Confused? You won't be after this episode." We'll try to unravel this one on State Week. Our panel this week includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS, Brian Mackey, WUIS and IPR State House Reporter, and our guest, Carrie Lester of the Associated Press. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Carrie, welcome to the show this week.
Nice to be back.
And to start things off, Carrie, what do we know? And eventually we'll get to what do we not know. But let's start with what we know on what we heard there from Dan Rutherford.
Well, he began that bizarre press conference last Friday, Bill, with a statement of, "Let me be perfectly clear." And I think the one thing that's clear is that nothing is clear with this story. What we do know is that there is an employee who is planning to file a claim against the treasurer, making allegations that many of us have learned in recent days include political coercion and sexual harassment. But that claim has not yet been filed. The employee is not willing to put his name out there yet. And so everyone seems to be waiting for the other shoe to drop. In the meantime, the treasurer has launched this internal investigation. Rumor has it that the findings could be released mid-next week, but that firm date is not yet out there either.
Amanda Venicky.
So, yes, as Carrie said, I think what's really to add to the intrigue of all of this is not only the allegations made by this accuser who has submitted a letter of resignation to the treasurer's office and thus no longer an employee, but also that there is the added political element that as Dan Rutherford is the, in at least the latest polls, was the number two to who is considered to be the front runner in the GOP Republican race for Governor Bruce Rauner, accusing Rauner to be behind this, that it's basically a setup, something that Rauner has denied, but Rutherford says he believes, quote, in his heart, that is the case after, as we heard in the opening there, Rauner has supposedly all of these books and research and willing to destroy his candidates. Again, Rauner saying no, but the only piece of evidence, or if you even want to call it that, that the treasurer has been able to provide is that the accuser's attorney is a woman who had been paid a fee by the Rauner campaign. This was for work that she had done months ago, but is suspicious in that it seems to be a pretty hefty amount for what the Rauner campaign says was lease work. then again, that's the only real connection.
Well,
that
don't make
we
that sound like big by saying hefty. It's still not big money. We're talking what, $3,500?
$3,500, but hefty, but for a lease is what most attorneys
for reviewing a lease.
Mm-hmm. For reviewing a lease. Mm-hmm. And so, but that's really the only connection that we've been able to see.
The number that I heard that was hefty was this claim of $300,000. Tell me what's going on with that.
Well, you know, it's not clear exactly why this was set as a benchmark. Rutherford describes it as a sort of shakedown attempt, but we've also heard that it was based on precedents and a certain amount that would be paid based on the type of claims that are being made. But as a reporter, this is a very, very difficult thing to put on the wire. You don't have the names of people coming forward yet. You don't have the official charges. And so I feel like we've all been chasing our tails for the last 4 days.
And it is one of these situations where people do hear the gossip. They expect coverage somewhere, would like to see it. But then those things called facts and ability to obtain them and confirm them seem to get in the way.
Well, and that's where this has been, as Carrie said, I mean, difficult, and yet I think there's been a lot of attention to that it was the treasurer himself who brought this out into the open, and the effect that is had on the coverage, that it may be different where there to be rumors or, you know, gossip, but when you have the treasurer bringing this out in front, and it is generally a conventional wisdom, get out in front of an issue. That's what politicians are supposed to do versus following up on it and, you know, having to go the apology route. And yet, because he is not and is unable, as it's a personnel issue, a potential legal issue, what have you, able to really speak about it, this press conference, that's why it was so bizarre. You could hear the emotion in his voice. This is a man who has clearly been working for years to try and be governor, possibly slipping through his fingers because of this, so close to an election. There's the timing of it. And then there's, again, his inability to be able to say the nature of the allegations. Then again, that, as you said, Bill, leaves everybody wondering, well, then what are these allegations? There are members of the media, I know, I spoke with the accuser who said, yes, you can go on the record with saying that this was sexual harassment and there was, I felt pressured to do political work and yet unwilling to go forward with his name. At what point in time does that have to happen? We're waiting. Will there be anything filed, or could it perhaps go through the Human Rights Commission or something? And again, there are plenty of places where this could be locked up and not really made open to the public. So there's so many dynamics at play from that perspective as well.
I just think at the end of the day, and excuse me for interrupting you, Bill, it is just such a risky political strategy by Rutherford to put part of the story out there and then kind of unleash the media on it. You've seen what has happened over the last week.
It occurred to me at the time that for whatever reason, I think the treasurer believed that a story was going to break and it was going to look really, really bad for him, and he was trying to get ahead of the story. Now, the story hasn't broken yet, but to me that's the only plausible reason why you would go ahead and kind of shine a spotlight on this stuff.
So one would surmise from that he perhaps had been interviewed by a journalist somewhere regarding this?
Yeah, or he had heard, hey, Charlie Wheeler from the Sun-Times is poking around asking these kinds of questions, one of his advisors might say. And so rather than see this splashed on the front page of the Sun-Times, you might want to try and make a preemptive strike and get your story out there, your spin on whatever the allegations are, before you're back on your heels in a defensive posture.
I will say that we had an interview scheduled with him Friday morning, and that was abruptly canceled. And we're going to ask about a wide range of topics, and then all of a sudden this press conference popped up very, very suddenly.
Yeah, he is making appearances. He's appeared before some editorial boards, and this week appeared at a business-related debate up in Chicago's western suburbs. So it's not as if he's avoiding the press now or anything like that. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Tony Arnold, who's one of our public radio colleagues at WBEZ, was at that debate in the suburbs, and he said Mr. Rutherford is usually one of the people who hangs around the longest afterward talking to reporters, and he really quickly got out of there at that point. But you're right. He did go before the Chicago Tribune editorial board this week. I believe he was in Springfield at the State Journal Register editorial board. So he is back sort of in public to an extent. One of the other things I thought – it's pretty challenging and difficult to get into this here, but I think it needs to be mentioned, and I would commend any of our listeners to go read Greg Hines's story earlier this week, in which he sort of says that one of the things that he sees happening here is the media sort of tiptoeing on the issue of, and I'm quoting here from Greg Hines's column, of whether Mr. Rutherford is or is not gay. And he talks about some of the coverage that's come out and people suggesting stories to the media about Rutherford traveling with a young aide and staying in hotels like that. And I think that this is sort of the subtext that's going on here in the Republican primary. And, I mean, it's not something that anyone's really comfortable delving into, but it is something that's worth thinking about, I think.
And you mentioned Greg Hines. He writes for Crane Chicago Business.
Crane, yeah, thank you.
And that is one of these underlying things, but then – by even bringing it up in one respect, appears that we're just being salacious and talking.
Right, and I mean, it's really no one's business, but I mean, it is sort of a background factor here. And, you know, and one of the other factors here I think that's worth considering is that, Dan Rutherford is well known in the State House. He's well liked by, in some ways, like I can say just as a reporter from that standpoint, he is down here a lot more than the governor. We see him a lot more than Attorney General Lisa Madigan, for example. Before Christmas time, he was walking around the press room just saying hello to people. He is relatively accessible for someone in his position. On the other hand, we've also heard him get very short-tempered with staff on conference calls if the technology wasn't working, for example. We heard a story this week where it was alleged that he had sort of a petty attitude towards a staff member. So, I mean, none of this comes in a vacuum. There is definitely a broader context going on here.
And I would say to Brian's point, that is an issue I've looked at for years, both when I was at the Daily Herald and now since I've moved to the AP. I've looked into Rutherford kind of blurring lines between campaigning and governing. There was an instance a few years ago where he sent a glossy state-funded mailer to 850 top donors who had given him collectively several million over the years. Then he spent a lot of money, $2 million or so, on rebranding the iCash program, which was already working very, very well. And most recently, we looked at him traveling around the state to promote this unclaimed property program, the iCash program, and staying overnight at the state's expense. Often had political fundraisers in those small towns. So the issue of political coercion and the blurred lines between campaigning and leading, I'm certainly interested in that coming to light with this unique case.
Well, and there's so much subtext there with not just the treasurer, but in all of Illinois politics. You see a lot of staffers that work for, say, a legislative caucus or a constitutional office that then move over to working for a campaign before election time. And that is a very standard practice. And whereas there are a lot of Illinois laws and rules that are supposed to make very clear what one does on state time versus what one does on personal time, you do end up with a whole lot of individuals, say, you know, taking a leave of absence or a whole lot of vacation days around an election time. So they're careful in that way to dot the I's, cross the T's, but you never know what sort of underlying pressure may be there. And that's where it does get difficult to sort out from the outside and even probably from the inside. Is it okay to say no, that I don't want to go out and campaign or that I don't want to go on a parade? Or could that mean that later on maybe somebody else will get the promotion instead of me and there won't be any one particular reason, just there's one job and I will be less favored to have done it? And so much of that at play in all of Illinois politics.
Now I have a question, and it will be conjecture on your part, but do you think many voters, especially Republican primary voters, have even taken much note of the issue going on around Dan Rutherford?
Because a resounding yes.
You think they have?
I think there are people. I mean, I heard from, quote unquote, civilians, people who are not in state government, but you know, who just live in Springfield, talking to somebody at the gym this week, as a matter of fact, who said, you know, just like, what is going on with this Rutherford stuff? I think it is kind of penetrating out there into the culture, into the society at large, the way that a lot of political stories maybe don't.
I mean, pensions, let's be clear, that has been a major issue for in Illinois politics for years. It has, of course, ramifications for the state budget, for people who are depending on a pension and their relatives and what have you. But to your average person, I'm not sure how much traction that has. But yes, a state treasurer who is lobbying allegations against another candidate and then it has accusations leapt against him. Yes, I think that very much does. You look at a show like House of Cards that has been immensely popular on Netflix. You just don't have political junkies watching that. That it's intrigue and political theater. And this is almost, I mean, that's that playing out in reality. So I think that it's far easier for a voter to wonder. People that didn't know who Dan Rutherford was probably do now.
And, you know, but once again, it is worth noting to your point, Bill, I think that argues on favor of people maybe not giving this as much credence, is that Bruce Rauner is still on the air with his millions and millions of his own dollars and hundreds of thousands of dollars from some very wealthy backers with many TV ads. And the other candidates, Dan Rutherford is just starting to get an ad up this week. And as far as I know, neither of the other candidates have any TV ads on broadcasting or cable.
And I've been told on occasion that nobody really pays attention until it's on TV. So I think right now there is an awful lot of speculation as to what's going on with the treasurer, and certainly there is that sexuality subtext. But I will be interested to see whether that makes its way onto the airwaves and how and from whom.
And the reason I ask that is because some of the basic facts, while interesting, may not fully be capturing the attention like a political scandal might do. And some of these subtexts have rightfully been kept out of those stories because of confirmation or people's unwillingness to come forward or only partially come forward, when perhaps if you're leveling such a charge, you should fully be present. So that's why I asked that question. Charlie, do you have any observations on this matter so far?
Well, it occurs to me that it's, I guess for me, it's kind of disappointing that the question of one's sexuality might be such a red flag. I had hoped that we had moved beyond that. We're a state that has legalized gay marriages. We were slow in coming to banning discrimination based on sexual orientation, but we finally did that. And then we're trying to treat people who are gay as being just as normal as everybody else. And I personally believe that one's sexual orientation is not something that you choose. It's not like you decide, oh, today I'm going to get I'm going to get my head shaved, or today I'm going to get colored contact lenses. You're hardwired genetically for your sexual orientation. And so unless it has some bearing on one's ability to serve as a public servant, then I think it should be immaterial. I would have hoped that we're beyond that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Charlie, but you just need to – I mean, obviously you know that when the same-sex marriage legislation did come up in the legislature last year, I think 4 Republicans total voted for it.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not suggesting that it's different. I guess I'm lamenting the fact that we're still kind of rooted in this – what I would consider kind of a 19th century morality, if you will.
And I think that may be the case, Charlie. You're right, in my opinion. However, I think what is at play here is beyond that. There is a subtext of that, nonetheless, and it is difficult because at this point there is not a lawsuit. But there is more than that. It's sexual harassment, whether it's by or to a male or a female, and also this element of potential political coercion. Again, at this point, it's just allegations. We don't know, but the treasurer did come out saying that there were some sort of allegations. For whatever reason, he did do that. So I don't think that the media or, you know, anybody is at fault for looking into those aspects of it, because those could be very serious outside of any sort of sexual orientation.
Oh, no, I agree. And to me, the troubling thing is that also, and this is something that I would have wished we would have gone beyond, the fact that if you're on a public payroll, you're expected to go out and do political work whether you want to or not. Now, there are a lot of people who are on public payrolls who are only too happy to do political work because they're true believers in the office or the party or the office holder. And that's well and good. But if you're in a situation where, as was expressed earlier, you have the concern that my ability to keep my job or to get a promotion depends on me working for a party or a candidate, I think that's improper.
You're listening to State Week in Review.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Venicky, Brian Mackey, and the AP's Carrie Lester. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Well, we've spent a good chunk of the show talking about gubernatorial politics. Let's move on quickly to a couple of other things. Brian Mackey, probably this is something that the people out on the streets may not care about, but the legislature has approved moving the governor's budget address until late March, which that led to a little bit of gubernatorial fighting on the Illinois Senate floor.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it's not unusual for the legislature to give the governor more time to give the budget address. It's happened, I don't remember the exact statistic, but numerous times in the past few decades. But this is one of the later times, the end of March, and some of the Republicans, especially those who are running for higher office, Senator Kirk Dillard, Senator Bill Brady, and Senator Jim Oberweis, Dillard and Brady, of course, running for governor. Oberweis is running for U.S. Senate in the primary to go against Senator Durbin later this year. They all made the point that they thought the governor's request to delay this was until after the primary and that it was a political thing. They allege that the governor really wants to know who he's going to run against in the primary. And, I guess the implication there is that that could change the way the governor structures his budget message. If it's going to be one of the Republican candidates who has taken a very staunch anti-tax increase line, then maybe the governor feels like he has to take that position as well. Or if it's one of the candidates who's been a little more open to adjusting the tax structure and maybe even agreeing to keep some portion of the income tax hike, well, then maybe the governor would have a little bit more leeway in his budget message. But there was the back and forth that you're referring to, Bill. Senator Cullerton, the Senate president, had a little fun with this by saying, well, let's take the day that the governor was going to come here and we'll just open it up for anyone. So you guys come up with your budget proposals. Surely people who have been running for governor for 5 years have some ideas about what their budget should be.
And to tell you the truth, were I the governor, I would have given the address on the scheduled date, which is just a couple of weeks away, and I would have challenged the Republicans because we all know what the governor has to do. He has no choice. By law, he has to propose a budget that's going to have to cut close to $2 billion from current spending levels. There's no way around that. And so he puts forward his budget and he says, okay, here's what's going to happen. We're going to have to cut education. We're going to have to cut health care. We're going to have to cut human services. And you can forget about this nonsense about, well, the legislature shouldn't take its pay and then we'll save, we'll go close the gap. That would take hundreds of years to do the job. And challenge them. Here's what the situation is. Now, you guys want my job. What would you do in my shoes? You give me your best ideas and not let them off the hook.
Well, and this is one of the challenges if you are somebody who, like a lot of Republicans do, and even some Democrats, pride yourself on being a fiscal conservative, is that when you do come down to the numbers, and you've talked about this many times before, you look at going facility by facility and closing things that are in people's district, that are job machines. There's sometimes the best jobs you can get in a downstate town is at a prison, for example. It's very difficult to make those votes and to make that choice in the line by line in the budget. I once heard a Democrat senator make the quip that, Republicans are fiscal conservatives until it comes to closing a facility in their district, then they act like New Deal Democrats.
I was interested.
What would you say? My smart alecky observation was always waste is any government program from which I personally don't benefit.
Carrie, you were trying to get a point in?
Sorry, Carrie.
No, my fault, Charlie. I was just interested to hear some leading Democrats' justifications for the governor asking for this to be pushed back when they had floor debate on it. House Speaker Michael Madigan referenced the fact that the governor was planning a five-year long-range budget proposal. And just speculating and having the wheels turning after that, it just had me thinking about how he could potentially soften the blow of asking for an extension of the income tax increase by stretching out its results over a five-year period. So I suppose time will tell.
Well, and it occurs to me one of the better suggestions that's come forward, I think it was Senator Dillard who put it forth in – maybe it was a news conference that you guys covered yesterday when he talked about appointing a commission to actually look at the state's revenue structure to overhaul the whole thing.
Take time now for some notes from the field. Amanda Venicky.
I found it interesting that that House Speaker Mike Madigan, who we all know likes to support his incumbents and wants to maintain his stronghold on his leadership role, which there doesn't seem to be any question of occurring, but nonetheless, despite having gone forward with ousting Representative Derek Smith from office originally after allegations surfaced of bribery in Smith's role as a state representative, is now using one of his campaign organizations to contribute to Smith's campaign for re-election. And this is a campaign where Smith is actually seeing a whole lot of individuals try and make a play and run for that office instead. But despite Illinois' ethical pasts and Madigan's having, you know, backed Rod Blagojevich only to see him go to prison, Derek Smith, of course, denying that he is in the wrong in this case, but nonetheless, getting support for his reelection campaign.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the Illinois economy continues to grow, but at a very slow pace. The Flash Index from the University of Illinois, Professor Fred Gerritz, shows that in January, we went to 107.2 from 107 in December. Anything above 100 is growth, but as the professor notes, it's a slow but steady pace.
Carrie Lester.
I was very, very interested to see the Senate Education Funding Advisory Committee's recommendations after 6 months of hearings this week. They are asking for the school funding formula to be really streamlined and put Chicago public school funding and categorical funding in the same pot as general state aid funds and to distribute whatever money we have, whatever happens with the tax increase, more fairly. So I'll be interested to see if this evolves into a debate as session goes on.
Brian Mackey.
Yeah, three of the four men running for the Republican nomination have said this week at that debate in the suburbs we talked about earlier that they want to lift the ban on increasing nuclear power in Illinois. Bruce Rauner, as he's done with a lot of issues, says he wants to look at it a little more. But this comes as Exelon says it's going to decide by the end of the year whether it's going to shutter some nuclear facilities that are losing money because power prices have gotten so low in this country. Some analysts have looked at Clinton and Quad Cities as two potential plants that could be closed by the end of the year, as the candidates say they want to expand nuclear power.
That's our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to our guest, Carrie Lester of the Associated Press. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.